Thanks, Mike. And welcome to everyone to another edition of Broken Bread, a weekly Bible studies brought to you by Mike Coles from newliferadio.co.uk and me, Ron Bailey, from BibleBase.com. We conspire together in love to serve you with these weekly helpings of truth from the Scriptures. And we're currently in a series of studies that we've based on a book that I wrote some years ago now called The Better Covenant. So this is The Better Covenant, a study guide. And this is study number 4 that we've entitled Abraham's Covenants. So let's start off with an introduction. This is quite a long one, but there's a reason for that. Maybe you recall, those of you who have been with us previously, and if you're here for the first time, well, a special welcome to you. And please feel at home, and do get in touch with us and tell you how you're making out with these different studies. We're always glad to hear feedback from our listeners. So I often use a little mantra, as I call it, which is context, 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 which really implies this, that when we're studying the Bible as a whole, when we're looking at truth in a wide kind of expanse, it's really important that we ask some basic questions, questions that have to do with the context of the text that we are reading. And the context really is an answer to certain questions. Questions like, who wrote this? Why did he write this? To whom did he write this? From where did he write this? To where did he write this? And so on. In other words, what we're trying to do, it's this conviction that if we're going to understand the Scriptures, we'll need to understand what the writer meant to convey in what he was writing. And to do that, if we can, we need to get some idea of the people that he was writing to. And then that puts us in much better shape to examine things, not just as isolated texts of Scripture, precious though those may be to us, but actually we can see the big picture. So this is an introduction. As I say, it's a long one. Call this one Step by Step. There's a verse in Romans chapter 4 and verse 12 where Paul is speaking about Abraham and Abraham's faith and making the point that people who were under the old covenant, that's to say the Sinai covenant, had an obligation not only to keep the law but also to walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. And that seems a an inoffensive verse, but it really has amazing implications. You see, it speaks of faith not just as a giant leap into the dark, but as a series of steps. And although there are times when our faith is a giant leap into the dark, more often I think we find it a series of steps, and quite often a series of stops between the steps while things are consolidated or tested. So Paul writes of Abraham and Abraham's character and his life and the way that God led him. And he says he refers to the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. So let's see if we can identify some of these steps of faith. You see, following on from that last verse that we just read, he speaks of the steps of faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. So these steps of faith are pre-covenant. They are before Abraham had justifying faith. They were before he had covenant with God. They were before he was circumcised. While he was still just Abraham, had not become Abraham, Abraham was already walking by faith. Did you know that? That Abraham was walking by faith before he was justified by faith. That's something for us to think about. The step that brought him to the place of justifying faith, the step of faith that brought him out of Ur, was probably 10 years earlier. We'll mention that a little bit later on. In fact, if we want to do this thing, it's helpful maybe to have a look at Stephen's summary of the life of Abraham, which is often called Stephen's defense. These were Abraham, as he was that time, first steps. So we're trying to put it into context, context, context. And of course, the final context will be, what does this mean to me? And what are the implications for the way I live my life? So we'll go to Acts chapter 7, verse 2 to 5. And he said, this is Stephen speaking, and he said, "Brethren and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran, and said to him, 'Get out of your country and from your relatives, and come to a land that I will show you.'" He said more than that, but we'll come on to that a bit later. Chapter 7, verse 4, "Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell." So what Stephen is doing here is he's looking at the narrative that we have in Genesis chapter 14. And he's realizing that actually Abraham's journey didn't begin at Shechem. It didn't begin at the moment of his faith in God for an heir. It began a lot earlier than that. In fact, it began way back in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Ur of the Chaldees was not, I often say this, was not a godless zone. It was God-infested. They had dozens, hundreds of them. And in the midst of that, God revealed himself to this man, Abraham. The God of glory appeared to our father, Abraham. The walk of faith always begins with God. That's how the Bible begins, isn't it? In the beginning, God. In every genuine beginning, God. And here is the God of glory who appears to our father, Abraham, when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran. So he's telling us that we can see at least one step here, one leg of the journey, if you like, in which he moved from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran. We'll see a bit more about that shortly. "And God said to him, 'Get out of your country, from your relatives, come to a land that I will show you.' Then he came out of the land of Chaldees and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which we now..." So there are two definite legs of this journey. He moved from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, and he stayed there. And when his father died, he then moved on into the land of Canaan, of Shechem. And then he says this in chapter 7 of verse 5, "And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give it to him for a possession and to his descendants after him." So you start off with nothing except a revelation of God and Abraham obeying step by step as God speaks to him and bringing him finally to the land. And when he gets into the land, God says, "This is it. This is the land I was talking about." And he gives it to Abraham as an inheritance, He didn't even have enough to set his foot on it. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give it to him for a possession and to his descendants after him. Notice that was a promise. I'm going to make a point here. He promised to give it to him for a possession. This is not yet a covenant. At this point, Abraham is pre-covenant. He's on his journey, the steps of faith. He's traveling. At this point, he hasn't come to the place of justifying faith. Let's dig a little deeper, because there are some words in here that are really, I think, significant. Well, there in Acts chapter 7 and verse 2, this is Abraham at this stage in Ur of the Chaldees. And before he dwelt, our version here says, before he dwelt in Haran. That word dwelt is an interesting one because it's actually the word settle. So it really means to kind of dwell in a house. Sojourning tends to mean to dwell in a tent, but this word really has the house word of house built into it. He settled down. So he hasn't got to the place that God has promised him yet. He hasn't seen it yet. And somehow he's had sufficient faith to take that stake that took him to Haran. And they paused there. Maybe Terah, his father, was sick. I don't know. We don't know how long he was there for. We know that God blessed him while he was there. And that he came out of Haran with increased herds and a tribe that had gathered around him. So he settled in Haran. And in Liddell and Scott, which is a lexicon of New Testament words, they say it really means to settle there or establish there as colonists. That's how it was used. So Abraham is putting roots down. He puts roots down in Haran. And it seems as though from some point and for some reason, that conviction in his heart came to him again. And he knew he had to continue his journey. He knew he hadn't arrived at the place that God had promised him. The distances involved in this are not inconsiderable. The journey from Ur to Haran is about 190 miles. Now, remember that he's traveling with his family. This is like a little tribe of people who are traveling. He's traveling with them and with some of their herds, their cattle. This is a long journey, 190 miles. We don't know how long he was there, but by that time his tribe had grown, and his herds had grown, and now he has a 600-mile journey south to Shechem. So we are following the steps of Abraham. Step one took him from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran. Step two took him from Haran to Shechem. Let's have a look how this follows on. We'll compare Acts chapter 7, which we've just looked at, with Genesis chapter 12, because Genesis chapter 12 is the more full expression of this, and Stephen in Acts chapter 7 is actually just taking parts of it. He's synopsizing it, in a sense. So listen to this. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abraham. At this moment he is in Haran. But the Lord had said to Abraham, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. You see, he didn't tell Abraham where he was going. He didn't give him a label on a map. He didn't even tell him the direction. He just said, go. And you say, where? Well, the writer of the Hebrews takes this up and he says he went out not knowing whither he went. In other words, Abraham believed God. He obeyed that word to leave these things behind, partially to begin with, and then to come to the place where God would say, this is the spot. This is the place of the promise. So it goes on to say this. Get out from your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you. Notice these I wills. This is God speaking. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now that's actually reading from, I think, probably the New King James Version. And this version that you see in front of you here is actually the American Standard Version, where it says this, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. There are quite a few translations that do this, because they've realized that this verb is in the imperative style, which really means this is a command. This isn't a promise. in you that you will be a blessing. This is a command. I will bless you, God says, and you be a blessing. Be thou a blessing, singular. This is a personal directive to Abram, as it begins here, that he is to be a blessing. In other words, that God blesses him with is not only to make himself sleek and fat and comfortable. It is in order that others shall be blessed. So are all the blessings. So in this statement here that we have in Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1, there are commands. Get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. There are promises. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. Be thou a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. These are all promises. In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. These are promises. And then, if we follow the American Standard Version, we've got a commission, and a commission, not only a promise, but a commission. I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. So we've got commands, promises, and a commission, but not a mention of covenant. Have you noticed this? Promises, blessings, commission. This is a man who's coming under the authority of God, and God's telling him what to do, but he isn't in covenant with God yet. He's still on his journey. These are the steps of the faith of our father, Abram. Now let's have a look at the first time we do find Abram in the company of a covenant. And it may be one you've hardly even noticed because it's somewhat obscured by the way that our modern versions usually translate this. So let's have a look at what I'm calling Abram's first covenant. One of the things we've said earlier about covenant, and remember we're adding different colours to a splodge of mixed colours on our artist's palette, from which we are creating a colour which will have all these shades and contexts and textures in it in order to use it later in a way that evokes all the different ingredients that have gone into this amazing Bible word covenant. And we said that right from the very beginning of covenant, we see that a covenant has at least two parties, because a covenant, of course, is an agreement. It's a very special kind of agreement, a very solemn legal agreement, but it has to have at least two parties who are parties to that covenant. And this is how it reads in the New King James Version. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Anah, and they were allies with Abram. And you say, I thought you said we were going to talk about covenants. Where's the word covenant? Well, it's hidden inside that word ally. And they were allies with Abram. Now, I want to go through this story because it's part of the steps of Abraham, and it gives the context of covenant and brings aspects of covenant through which I think are helpful in our overall understanding. Let's have a look then at the covenant partners. Well, according to this verse, they are three people, three men: Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and brother of Anah. So that's three men, three Amorites, and they were allies with Abraham. In fact, this word means to be the masters of a covenant, and I'll say something more about that in a moment. But these three Amorites, who are descendants of Ham, you remember Shem, Ham, and Japheth? Well, the Amorites are descendants of Ham and the Canaanites. And here Abram, as he is at this stage, enters into a covenant with Amorites, three of them, Mamre, brother of Eshcol. You notice by the terebinth trees of it's clear that Mamre and Eshcol and Anah owned this land, or at least had claimed possession of it. And here comes Abram, and they were allies with Abram. There is a covenant between a Hebrew, a Shemite, and three Amorites. In Genesis 10, it tells us that Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and it goes through all these lists. So these three men were descendants of Ham, not of Shem. So let's have a look at the terms of Abram's first covenant. This is the word that's translated allies, Baal Berith. Now, the Hebrew word Berith is the word for covenant, and that's a word that's used over 300 times, at least I think, in the Bible. But when it has Baal in front of it, you've come across the word Baal almost certainly. You remember the Baals were the name of the foreign god, constantly intruded into the work that God was trying to do with his people when they came into the land. And there was a controversy at times between the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Jehovah. Now, Baal, it becomes the name of that particular god. He was a kind of a fertility god, the god of thunder and power. But it also means the word Lord. So a woman's husband might be called Baal. And someone in charge of a situation might be called Baal. It really means the master. So Baal Berith, literally, if we translated it richly, is Lord of the Covenant. Now, let's put that into our verse from Genesis chapter 14 and verse 13. I'll tell you why he's escaped and where he's come from in a moment or two. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Anah, and they were masters of the covenant with Abram. Ooh. They were masters of the covenant with Abram. It seems that in the terms of the first covenant, Abram was the junior partner, and these three brothers were the senior partner. He is on their land, or the land that they claim as their own, and they enter into some kind of agreement, some kind of covenant between these two groups of people, Abraham and his people, and Mamre, Eshcol, and Anah with their people. So you've got this covenant between a Hebrew and three Amorites. So here is the term, that they are the masters of the covenant. He is the junior partner. He will make an agreement of the way that he will live in a way which benefits them, and they will make a promise to live in the way which benefits him. And we discover that almost certainly this is some kind of tenancy agreement. He's actually living by the terebinth trees that belong to Mamre. So this covenant is a tenancy agreement. Abraham the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre. But it's not only that, and you can see this as this particular story unfolds, and we will see it. It's also a defense treaty, because these two covenant parties, the Amorite brothers and Abraham, have obviously entered into an agreement which, as part of the agreement of the tenancy and of their covenant, is this clause, if you like, that if they come under enemy attack, if Abraham comes under attack, then the Amorite brothers will come to his aid. And if the Amorite brothers become subjected to attack, then Abraham will come to their aid. So it's a defense treaty. Baal Berith, it's this covenant. It's an interesting idea, this, the idea of them being people who were joined together for their mutual security. No doubt they had differences, but they kind of held back on their differences in order to enter into a relationship which was to their mutual profit. No doubt, it would not have been perfectly satisfactory to Abraham, and it wouldn't have been perfectly satisfactory for the Amite brothers, it would, like most covenants, have been a compromise. There's only one covenant which was not a compromise. Can you guess which one it is? You've got it. It's the better covenant. Do you remember when Jesus was on the earth and he was speaking? He'd been asked a question about divorce and remarriage and when it was legal to divorce a wife or not. And the conversation developed into a bit of a confrontation. And they said to Jesus, Jesus had said, well, there's no conditions at all except for adultery. That's the only reason. And they immediately came back and they said, ah, but Moses said that a man could put aside his wife for a reason, and that was it. And Jesus made this extraordinary comment, and it is a comment that I think we should keep in our minds all the time when we read the Bible. Because Jesus said, Moses allowed you to put away your wife. But from the beginning, it was not so. He allowed you to put away your wives because of the hardness of your hearts. From the beginning, it was not so. This tells us something really very profound and sobering about the way that God deals with people. That is that under certain circumstances, he will permit, he will allow what is imperfect. He will allow a kind of compromise. He will determine the terms, but he will allow things that are not perfect. But from the beginning, it was not so. And Pentecost is a new beginning. And in the beginning, things that were so in the old covenant are not so in the new covenant. There's no compromise in the new covenant. If any man be in Christ, he has become a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. But I wanted to show you just an illustration of this idea of a defense treaty. And how, in a way, it may even feed into this story here. In the 1990s, there was what's known as the First Gulf War, and there were 36 coalition forces from 35 nations. Led by the United States against Iraq in response to Iraq's invasion and annexed Kuwait. This is all from Wikipedia, so it must be. It doesn't matter whether this isn't, I'm making the point here. That coalition army that was gathered together operated under two different projects, if you like. There were two different operations which were given code names. The first code name was Operation Desert Shield. And what they did was there was a massive buildup of troops in Saudi Arabia in particular in order to make sure that the forces of Iraq didn't push into Saudi Arabia and take their oil reserves as well. So it was a defensive covenant. It was a defensive operation, and they called it Operation Desert Shield. And then when Iraq refused to kind of give up conquests that it had made in Kuwait, they decided that they would go to war proper, and they called that stage of that war Operation Desert Storm. So you had, in the Gulf War, you had these two stages. You had Operation Desert Shield, Operation Desert Storm. Why? Well, I want to talk about the shields. This is telling you the story now of how it was, and how that covenant with those men, the Amorites, worked out. This is Genesis 14 and verse 22. Abraham said to the king of Sodom, this is after, do you remember this story? Shall I tell you just very quickly? Abraham had settled in by the terebinth, by the oaks of Mamre, Anor, and Eshcol. And that was a covenant with a treaty, a kind of a defense treaty, but it seems as though it was linked in another way with a wider covenant known as the Kings of the South. And there were five kings of the South, including, these were city-states, including the King of Sodom and the King of Gomorrah and others. And Lot, you remember, Abraham's nephew, had gone to live, first of all, looking towards Sodom, and then actually going into the city and becoming very much part of the life of Sodom. And what happened was four other kings from the farther north came down. And they, this is, read it, it's all in chapter 14. And it tells you that they had been kind of under the domination, paying no doubt some kind of tribute to these four kings of the north for 14 years. But in the 15th year, I think I'm getting the dates right, they decided they were not going to pay any tribute anymore. And the four kings of the north came down and declared war on the kings of the south, the five kings, and they took lots of people captive, taking them hostage back to their own land. And included in the captives that they took from Sodom was Lot, Abraham's nephew. And when Abraham heard that, he took 380 of his own trained men. So you'll see that Abraham was a man of some measure in these days. He took his private army of 380 men, and they staged a night raid on these people and completely broke their resistance, and actually were able to bring back all the captives so that none was lost, and able to bring back the spoils of war. So this now is almost the combined treasures of four city-state kings from the north and five city-state kings from the south. This is fabulous wealth. It's important to note that for what I want to say. This is Genesis 14. They come back and the king of Sodom has an offer to put to Abraham. He says, look, he said, you just give me my people back and you have everything. You have all the possessions. You have all the spoils of war. You have them all. You have them. Abraham has become a man of some status now in the area where he lives. This is an amazing offer. Abraham is now established as a military leader. He was already a wealthy man when he arrived there. Now he's got fabulous wealth. And the king of Sodom comes and says, well, you have all the wealth. You have all the spoils. Just give me my people back. That's fine. Genesis 14, verse 22. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up my hand unto Jehovah. That's the sign of an oath. He's lifting up his hand an oath unto Jehovah. He is naming the God that he calls upon as he makes this solemn vow. I have lifted up my hand unto Jehovah, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread nor a shoe latchet nor aught that is thine, lest thou shouldst say, I have made Abraham rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men that went with me, Anna, Eshkol, and Mamre. Look who's here. Look who was part of Abraham's force that went and gained that victory. These three Amorite brothers. And in this offer that the king of Sodom makes, Abraham specifically identifies them, says, nothing for me, except just what my young men ate, just their kind of traveling expenses, if you like. And the portion of the men that went with me, Anna, Eshkol, and Mamre. And that wouldn't have just been three men, that would have been three men and their private armies, their little groups of soldiers. Abraham never heard Jesus say, no man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. He'd never heard that. But he did know that this was a choice. There was a choice here that he was going to become dependent and more interconnected more part of the way in life and culture of these people in Sodom and Gomorrah, or he could make his choice, and he made his choice. And the choice that he made was to really give up all these fabulous riches, this spoils from the war of these 9 city-states. He gave it all up because it had a revelation through a man named Melchizedek that God, the Most High God, was the possessor. And Abraham had given a tribute to Melchizedek towards that God of a tenth of all that he had. And then it says this. I think this is an amazing thing. That brings you to the end of chapter 14. And then in chapter 15 it says, after these things, after what? After the successful counterattack of the alliance, Abraham stands high in public acclaim. He has a successful defense alliance that has been tested and proved effective. He has the combined wealth of the spoils of 9 city-states. He was wealthy at the beginning of the chapter. Now his wealth and power and influence make him a key figure in the region. And he has a revelation through the meeting with Melchizedek, the priest king of Salem, who receives his tribute and pronounces the blessing of the Most High God on him. And Abraham's reaction is that he sets his face in a different direction. Melchizedek, this is what had happened. Melchizedek, king of Salem, had brought forth bread and wine, and he was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him, Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and said, blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. He was promised the possessions of 9 city-states, and then he's told that there is a God who possesses heaven and earth. And he blessed God. And blessed be God Most High, who hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. That's Abraham gave a tenth of everything to Melchizedek. And then you come into this bit. And the king of Sodom said to Abraham, give me the persons and take the goods to yourself. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I've lifted up my hands unto Jehovah, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. I will not take a thread, nor a shoe latchet, nor anything that's thine, lest thou shouldst say, I have made Abraham, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men that went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. And chapter 15, verse 1 says this, after these things, the word of God came, the word of Jehovah came unto Abraham in a vision, saying, fear not, Abraham. I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. Abraham had turned his back on wealth and security and had lifted up his hand in the swearing of an oath to not just the Most High God, but to Jehovah, Most High God of heaven and earth. After Abraham's clear-cut choices and commitment, then after these things, after he'd made his choices, after he'd settled it on this, that God would be his God, and that only he would be responsible for Abraham's welfare and wealth, and thy exceeding great reward. I am thy shield. Abraham had had a kind of desert shield. He'd had this defense treaty with the 3 Amorite brothers. But now God says, I am thy shield. He'd turned down the possibility of fabulous wealth. And God says, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. It was after these choices, after these decisions, after these steps of the faith of our father Abraham, that the word of Jehovah comes to Abram. And in the next verses, Abram comes to the place of justifying faith. It becomes the defining nature of saving faith. But we'll leave that for another time. Do read, please, Genesis chapter 14. And get some idea of the political scenery of the day, of the unsettled nature of things, of how desperate life was and how vulnerable Abram and his people were in many ways. And understand the amazing choices he's making in turning his back on all the natural things which would give security and well-being and confidence for the future. And he is closing himself up entirely and putting himself into the hands of a God who he has just heard as the possessor of heaven and earth, and he's lifted up his right hand and he's sworn, only God will make me rich. And people come to the place where they choose that only God will make them rich, that it will be faith in God alone, their trust in him. They've come to the place of justifying faith. And we shall read more about that subsequently. All right, time for us to go. Thank you for spending this time with us. We really do look forward to your company, and we look forward too to your comments and any contacts that you make with us. And we look forward to seeing you, God willing, same place, same time next week. God bless you.